We'll hear argument first this morning in number 89, 5383, Mark Howlett versus Scott Rose. Mr. Beckett.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Mark Howlett brought an action under Title 42, Section 1983, the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1873, the defendants were the School Board of Pinellas County, Florida, and designated officials of that school board. The action charged two offenses, a violation of the 14th Amendment, of the Due Process Clause, and a violation of the Fourth Amendment. The allegation with respect to the Fourth Amendment was that the assistant principal of the high school at which Mark Howlett was a student broke into his automobile while the automobile was lawfully parked on the school ground. The second charge of violation of due process was that in the ensuing suspension, which he received for 5 days, the due process as ordained by this court was not granted. The Circuit Court of Pinellas County, Florida, is a court of general jurisdiction in which this action was brought. The Circuit Court of Pinellas County dismissed the action on two grounds. The first ground was that the sovereign immunity of the state of Florida barred the action. The second ground was that the administrative remedies had not been exhausted. On appeal, the District Court of Appeal of the Second District of Florida affirmed on the first ground and did not reach the second ground, the first ground being that there was a want of jurisdiction because of the sovereign immunity of the school board. Under Florida law, the school board is immune from suit. The question presented, therefore, is whether or not the school board is immune under federal law. The Supreme Court of Florida, with one justice dissenting, denied review, and this court granted certiorari. The first question to be addressed is simply the fact that the broad ground on which the District Court of Appeal of Florida affirmed the dismissal is, as a matter of law, incorrect, namely that whether or not jurisdiction exists when a state court exercises or attempts to exercise jurisdiction under 1983 is solely a matter of state law.
Well, Mr. Beckett, would it be fair to say that another way of phrasing the question here is whether a state court has to entertain an action brought under Section 1983?
No, Your Honor, we don't think that, because we think there's an intermediate ground in which this court has taken the position that where the suit brought on a federal claim is a claim which is within a class of claims that the state customarily exercises jurisdiction over, then even without addressing the question of whether the state would have to do it by direction of Congress, they would have to do it simply because it is within a class of claims which the state does entertain.
So your position is that the state entertains claims just like this against the state of Florida, but it doesn't entertain a claim against under Section 1983?
Not against the state of Florida, Your Honor, because one of the distinctions to be made is that although the school board is immune from suit under Florida law, it is not immune from suit under the rulings of this court under 1983.
And so what are the claims just like this that are so similar that Florida entertains that this should be entertained too?
If Your Honor, please, going back to Claflin against Houseman, an 1876 case in which Justice Bradley rendered the opinion of the court, The claim there was based on an assignment in bankruptcy. The state court refused to entertain it on the ground that the assignment in bankruptcy was solely a matter of federal law. In a rather elaborate opinion, Justice Bradley explained that because of the dual nature of our court system and the dual nature of the laws of this country, that the state court was required to entertain the action, an assignment in bankruptcy, because it routinely handled assignments in other matters. In other words, the mere fact that it was an assignment from federal law was not a reason to deny the claim.
Well, then what are the kinds of claims that Florida courts routinely handle that would cover this sort of claim?
Florida, Your Honor, has a general statute which abolishes or waives the statutory immunity of the state and its agencies in all tort claims except tort claims involving so-called discretion or discretionary acts. There have been a number of rulings, including a ruling by the Supreme Court of Florida, that this general waiver of tort liability does not extend to constitutional torts under 1983. And thus we have the juxtaposition, which Your Honor is inquiring about, a general release of authority, a general waiver with respect to torts, but as to constitutional torts, no waiver. That's the general setup.
Is there a waiver as to torts which were claimed to be violations of the state constitution? Have the Florida courts spoken on that?
Not in the legislature. There are one or two cases where the Florida Supreme Court has ruled that a denial of due process can be of such a nature that even though there's no provision under state law, it simply will not be allowed. One other point I'd like to make, Your Honor, in connection with that is that in Owen against the City of Independence, this court established the rule that there is no discretion to violate the Constitution. And so anticipating the argument which we have received in the brief from the opposition, one of the arguments is that the discretionary exception to the waiver covers this case. We maintain that it does not because of this court's position in Owen, simply that it's not constitutionally permissible to violate the Constitution. Therefore, there cannot be any discretion in that area. Consequently, the general waiver also has to include this class of cases unless there's going to be a discrimination against federal law. Another case illustrating the same point is Mondew against New York, a 1912 case under the Federal Employees Liability Act. There, the state of New York refused to enforce the FELA simply because it was contrary to the policy of the state of New York. This court said that any exception to enforcement must be depend on some outside reason. It may not depend on simply a dislike of the cause of action. In MacNet against San Francisco and the St. Louis and San Francisco Railway, 1934 decision written by Justice Brandeis, the operative provisions of the law there, or the law of Alabama there, were that a proceeding existed under the common law or under statute law could be brought in the courts of general jurisdiction of Alabama. But the FELA could not be brought because it was under federal law, and the express language of the Alabama statute did not include a claim based on federal law. In reversing the case, Justice Brandeis said that the question of jurisdiction, although originally a matter of state concern, is ultimately a question of federal concern. And if the only reason the similar claim is not enforced is simply because it is a claim based on federal law, that distinction cannot be observed, and the court must entertain that claim along with the other claims.
Mr. Beckett, could I ask
the other end, yeah.
Could I ask you to come back to this this discretionary point? Florida law says, and you agree that a tort claim will not lie under its waiver of sovereign immunity with respect to discretionary acts, and your response is that there is no discretion to violate the Constitution. Well, is that what Florida means by discretion? I mean, I assume that there's no discretion to commit any tort in that sense.
Well, that's not the sense in which it's used in Florida, Your Honor. There are a great many cases in Amicus brief in particular in which it's pointed out that any exercise of discretion, such as an executive decision where to put a traffic light, a policeman's failure to make an arrest, which ultimately resulted in a crime by the person not arrested, all of those things involving discretion in the exercise of official duties generally are said to be discretionary and consequently not waived.
Well, why isn't there some discretion involved here on the part of the principal as to whether he had authority to make the examination of the car that he did, and as to whether the procedures that were provided in the hearings were adequate? Why isn't there some discretionary judgment involved in that?
There's a distinction, Your Honor, between making a mistake and violating the Constitution. That's our position. For example, a decision that he had authority to change the hours of the school, or that he had authority to change, put the car in a different parking lot, are all discretionary matters. But he did not have discretion to violate the Constitution by breaking into the automobile when it was lawfully parked and locked and there was no danger that it was going to run away or anything like that. It was the violation is of the reasonable.
Didn't he have some discretion to decide whether there was danger that it was going to be taken away before he could get a warrant and before a proper investigation could be made?
No,
didn't somebody have to make that decision?
No, the facts were that the car was lawfully parked and locked where it had been lawfully parked and locked before. Apparently, there was a desire to drive a construction truck through that area, and the assistant principal was contacted, and it was decided it was necessary to move the car. Our position is that did not give him authority to violate the Fourth Amendment by making an unreasonable breaking in of the car. He had alternatives, and I think that's what Your Honor is suggesting. If you say, for example, did he have time to get away?
Well, you're making a quite different argument, though, now. Now you're making the argument that in the facts of this case, there was no discretion involved. But your initial argument was that no violation of Section 1983 could come within Florida's discretionary exception because there is simply never any discretion to violate the Constitution. That's a much broader argument.
I don't think I've changed that, Your Honor. If
you haven't changed it, but you're not defending it either. You're defending a quite different proposition.
If, as a matter of fact, there was some reasonable action that could be taken, that was the action which the statute or which the Fourth Amendment required. That is a factual matter. It's our position that there were ample actions that he could have taken without breaking into the car. Therefore, the breaking in was unreasonable, and therefore it was a violation. We don't deny he had a choice, but the choice he made violated the Fourth Amendment.
Mr. Beckett, did you raise in the courts below the question whether the complaint against the officials in their individual capacity had been dismissed?
No, Your Honor, we did not. Under Florida law, a granting of a motion to dismiss is error if it can be reversed on any ground, and we did not pursue those separate matters.
Do you know whether Florida courts will entertain 1983 actions against individual officers in their individual capacity?
We do know, and they will. Yes, there's an abundant law that the sovereign immunity claim.
So, in this case, you say that even if under the Florida law, the case against the officials in their official capacity should have been dismissed. In other cases, they entertain these suits in the individual capacity.
That's correct, Your Honor, and it's our opinion that such a distinction could have been made by the court in this case, but it was not, and we did not pursue that aspect of it. We pursued what we thought was the central concern, that is to say, the claim of sovereign immunity against the school board.
They refused to entertain 1983 actions entirely.
If I gave that impression, that is not our position. Our position is that where there is a distinction, as there is in this case, between liability under 1983 and immunity under the state law, 1983 controls. The question of immunity under 1983 is a federal question, and that, of course, was settled in Martinez. Here, the court, on the ground that we particularly attacked, said the school board was not liable because under Florida law it was not liable, and that was the end of the matter.
Well, you wouldn't say that if Florida had never waived any of its sovereign immunity for ordinary torts or any other set of torts, you wouldn't say that Florida had to entertain 1983 suits, would you?
We wouldn't say it on this basis, Your Honor. We would have to make it on a different basis, simply that it was the purpose of Congress to make it enforceable in state courts regardless. Our position here, as I said earlier, I believe is an intermediate position. Once the state has undertaken to grant jurisdiction or entertain a claim of the class of claims,
tort claims.
In this case, tort claims, of which the federal claim is itself a member, then it may not refuse to entertain that claim merely because it's a federal claim.
Would a Florida state court have entertained a tort suit by your client against Scott Rose as superintendent of schools for Pinellas County simply based on a violation of state tort duty?
No, it would not, if you mean in his official capacity.
Yes.
It would not.
Well, so how, isn't it fair to say that Florida is treating both claims based on the federal constitution, on state tort law, the same here? They're not allowing them against this particular entity in its official capacity?
We don't think so, Your Honor, and enunciated a little earlier, the fact that there is no discretion to violate the constitution. And the only exception to the waiver is the discretionary exception. So we think that, as a matter of fact, it cannot be brought within the discretionary.
Well, excuse me, the discretionary exception is the reason that an ordinary tort suit would not have been bringable in Florida? Is the discretionary exception the reason you responded to the Chief Justice the way you did, that the suit could not be brought?
No, it's not, Your Honor. The reason the suit could not be brought against the school board or against the superintendent in his official capacity is because they are immune from suit in their official capacities. If they were not immune, then the question would arise as to whether the act was discretionary. We say that it couldn't be discretionary.
They're immune, but you mean that they were protected by sovereign immunity.
That is correct.
Yes, sir.
That is correct. We also take the position that under federal law, sovereign immunity is just one more example of an immunity claim which can be brought or asserted under 1983. And we, of course, take the further position that it cannot be maintained.
Well, Mr. Beckett, if a state decided to waive its sovereign immunity, let's say only for intentional torts of any kind, do you think that you would be entitled to bring an action in state court based on Section 1983 for that kind of a tort?
The question would be whether or not the tort we were seeking to redress was intentional. It would clearly fall.
Don't think then that there could be any room for saying that a neutral state waiver of sovereign immunity to a limited extent can be upheld even though it's based on Section 1983 in state court.
That's really correct, Your Honor. And the reason is the reason I stated that there is no there is no authority to violate the Constitution.
Well, but that certainly isn't a discriminatory kind of statute, is it? That kind of waiver. There's the kind that we're discussing doesn't discriminate against federal claims. It's neutrally applicable to both state and federal claims.
We don't think it's neutral if the only effect of it is to preclude the assertion of a federal claim, which is an...
Well, that isn't the only effect. By assumption, it would preclude a state court action based on an intentional. I mean, it would waive it for intentional torts only.
That's true. That's true.
And why isn't that neutral?
Simply because under this court's decision is in Owen, it is not permissible to violate the Constitution. And both of these examples are intentional.
Well, of course, you could file your suit in federal court, could you not?
We could.
Yes.
That's correct.
Was there a reason for not filing it in federal court?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. We felt it was desirable to explore this area and to make 1983 available in state court. It was a deliberate decision to raise this question.
But that puts your client in, this particular client in a bind, doesn't it? Here he is up here now, arguing an issue which need not have been faced had he been in federal court.
That's true, and that was discussed with the client, and we explained to him what we thought we could do with this case, and he was in accord with that.
Well, I read your brief as suggesting that a state may not make its agencies or the counties and cities give them sovereign immunity because the 11th Amendment doesn't give them sovereign immunity.
Well, as Your Honor knows, the 11th Amendment has two,
well,
two
I know,
steps
but
removed.
You do argue that in your brief, don't you?
I don't believe we argue it that way. The 11th Amendment is two steps removed. The first is that we're in state court.
Yes.
The second is, as a result of this court's recent decision in Will, the state and its agencies are immune in any event.
Mm-hmm.
And this court said that in Doyle against the Mount Healthy City School Board, in which it also said that a school board was more like a county and a municipality, and for that reason, the liability carries over. We simply seek to enforce that liability in state court rather than in federal court.
Well, what law do you think? You say one of your arguments is that the scope of immunity defense under 1983 is governed by federal law.
That's true.
What federal law determines the immunity in this case?
1983. This court has
Tell me how it solves this problem.
And over a period of time, this court has recognized many immunities under 1983. Mm-hmm. Executive immunity in Tenney against Brandlove, judicial immunity in Ray against Pearson. That's the only two that occurred to me immediately, but there are any number. In fact, I have them.
Well, go ahead. Go ahead.
A list of them here. Shower against Rhodes was executive.
Well, how does 1983 help you in this case in establishing the limits of immunity?
Well, we start with the proposition that 1983 on its face shows no immunities. This court has recognized that there are a number of common law immunities which Congress presumably built into 1983. One of them is not the immunity of school boards. So we therefore say that 1983 controls this case as a matter of federal law.
On that basis, Florida just hasn't any business extending sovereign immunity to cities or its school boards. That seems to be your argument.
Extending sovereign immunity.
Yes, we're giving sovereign immunity to
or providing that cities may not be sued for constitutional torts in their in the state courts.
I'm not
you
sure
say 1983 I'm not, forbids that.
No, I don't think we say 1983 forbids it. It's up to the state of Florida initially as to what of its agencies or creatures it will grant immunity. And the state of Florida has done so. Our position is that under 1983, only those immunities which this court has recognized as a matter of federal law apply in state court. And one of those is not the immunity of school boards. Therefore, the school boards are not immune under federal law, even though they are immune under state law.
Thank you, Mr. Beckett. Mr. Rothfeld?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this case is fundamentally about the power of the states to establish and limit the jurisdiction of their own courts. And there is a single dispositive question here, whether a state court must entertain a Section 1983 action when it lacks jurisdiction to do so under state law, and when it also lacks jurisdiction to entertain analogous actions that are based on state law. And here I must disagree with the reading of Florida law that Mr. Beckett presented to you when he said that there was discrimination between state and federal claims. It is clear in this case that this District Court of Appeal didn't entertain petitioner's 1983 action. It simply concluded that because the school board respondent has a common law immunity, an action against it simply will not lie at all in state court.
Well, its language, Mr. Rothfeld, did say an action pursuant to Section 1983 will not lie in state courts. Now, what is the nature of the disability?
I think it is clearly a lack of jurisdiction in the state courts. Under Florida law, sovereign immunity is grounded in the state constitution. And under that law of Florida, as in most states, sovereign immunity entirely divests the court of subject matter jurisdiction to decide the case.
But the court below didn't really say we lack subject matter jurisdiction. It said we don't entertain Section 1983 suits.
Well, it said this action will not lie, and it went on to say yes. That petitioner was asking the Florida courts to recognize an action under federal law that it does not otherwise recognize.
Well, do state courts in Florida have jurisdiction over any Section 1983 claims?
Yes, they do. We agree that state courts routinely entertain actions against officials where sovereign immunity is not a jurisdictional bar. I think that clearly, in our view, what the court was doing here was applying subject matter jurisdictional bar that is created by sovereign immunity rules. I think there is no question. I don't understand petitioner to disagree.
Well, what is the extent of the waiver in Florida? Is it a waiver as to all but discretionary torts?
Well, let me say as a preliminary matter, I think petitioner is not well placed to make his argument about discrimination here because he did not make it to the state courts, which could have authoritatively settled it. Before the state courts, he argued simply that the Florida law of sovereign immunity was irrelevant in this case. He therefore did not argue discrimination. He did not even argue, for that matter, that the waiver was broad enough to permit his claim to proceed. And the District Court of Appeal therefore explicitly said it was not addressing the scope of the waiver. Because petitioner didn't present the argument to the state court that could have authoritatively settled it and solved this court the problem of investigating a complex area of Florida law, he shouldn't be heard to complain about that now. Beyond that, the District Court of Appeal clearly decided this case on the understanding that analogous claims, claims analogous to petitioners based on state law, would be barred. The court said explicitly that petitioner was asking the state to open its courts to federal claims that the state does not otherwise recognize. And in this very case, petitioner asserted claims based on the Florida Constitution along with his 1983 action. Both sets of those claims were dismissed, which seems to me fairly persuasive evidence that the Florida courts do not discriminate against claims based on whether they are state or federal. Beyond that, if the court were to look beyond the decision below to Florida law more broadly, it would find, I think, that Florida's waiver is not discriminatory.
We're not very well equipped to do that here. What do we do faced with an opinion couched in this language?
Well, I think the opinion on this point is is clear that, and again, quoting, that petitioner is asking Florida to recognize federal actions that the state does not otherwise recognize. It seems to me that that is a clear conclusion on the part of the District Court of Appeal, that there is no discrimination. I think that conclusion by the state court about the meaning of its state law should be dispositive here in this court. If there is any doubt on the point, I mean, the briefs cite an enormous number of opinions from the Florida courts dismissing actions brought against the state or its political subdivisions involving circumstances quite similar to this. I mean, if the court has doubt about the scope of Florida law, I think the solution would be to send the decision back to the Florida courts to determine whether discrimination exists, if the court thinks that that's a dispositive factor. But again, I think that the decision below gives the court ample ground to conclude that Florida courts do not view discrimination to exist.
Well, tell me how you define the extent of the sovereign immunity that is waived, because the statute, it's the statute that waives, isn't it?
That's right.
And it says that there's a waiver in all actions in tort for money damages against a state or its agents or subdivisions for injury or loss of property, personal injury or death caused by the negligent or other wrongful act or omission.
I think that the language that the Florida courts have focused on is a portion that makes the state liable in circumstances in which a private party would be liable. And the Florida courts have interpreted that, as we read their decisions, to exclude an area of governmental activity from liability. Now, Mr. Beckett said it's discretionary activity and not governmental activity.
Well, you just can't sue a city for damage to your property?
I think you can't sue a city for law enforcement, public safety activities.
For damage to your property.
One can sue a city for certain types of property damage, negligent property damage.
Or intentional property damage.
Well, I think that the line drawn by the Florida courts is very similar to the traditional distinction between governmental and proprietary actions. And an action taken by a city employee, which is said to make the city liable, which is of a sort that the Florida courts would characterize as governmental, as I think the action in this case is, simply will not give rise to liability.
Can you bring a suit under Florida law against a police officer for beating up a prisoner?
Against an individual police officer, yes, who was not protected by.
How about suing the city for that? How about suing the city for that conduct of the police officer?
No, I would think not, because that is related to governmental activities. It is an intentional violation of, well, I should say, let me stick with the line that the Florida courts have drawn. And I therefore think an action would not lie. And again, in this case, petitioner asserted both state and federal claims as the basis for his complaint. Both were dismissed, which again seems to me fairly persuasive evidence that this type of claim is not cognizable when based on state law in the state courts. Again, that was clearly the view of the state court in this case. And I think that view should be held to be dispositive of the meaning of state law. This sort of even-handed, non-discriminatory application of a jurisdictional rule is the sort of thing that the court has dealt with before. And I think it's the sort of thing the court has indicated clearly is not a violation of the federal Constitution. The court has addressed, in a variety of settings similar to this, the obligations that the Supremacy Clause imposes on state courts to enforce federal statutes. And it has routinely made clear that jurisdictional bars in the state, in the laws of the states to consideration of federal actions are valid to permit state courts to dismiss those actions. The court has said repeatedly, for example, most recently in its decision this term in Taflin versus Leavitt, that state courts may entertain federal actions when they have jurisdiction to do so under their state law and when Congress hasn't vested exclusive jurisdiction in the federal courts. The court has indicated several times in the cases that petitioner cites in Testa and McNett and Mondu that state courts must entertain federal actions if they have jurisdiction to do so under their state law and if they entertain analogous state law claims. And at the same time, the court has held repeatedly in cases like Douglas and Mayfield and Herb versus Pitcairn that states are not obligated to disregard even-handed limitations on their jurisdiction simply because the claim that's presented to them is federal. Douglas case presents a good example of this principle in operation. It was a suit brought in state court under a federal statute, the Federal Employers Liability Act. It was brought by a foreign, by a non-resident plaintiff against a foreign corporation defendant. It was dismissed by the state court, applying a state rule that gave its courts discretion to refuse jurisdiction over actions by foreign plaintiffs against foreign defendants. This court upheld that rule as a valid excuse for the denial of jurisdiction, even though it precluded the state court from hearing a federal action that had been created by Congress.
What's the name of that case, Mr. Rothfeld?
Douglas versus New Hampshire New York Railway.
Is it cited in your brief?
It is cited in Amicus brief for the National Association of Counties.
Which Amicus brief?
National.
There only one?
For the National Association of Counties. And it is discussed in the other briefs as well. Together, I think all of these lines of cases, which are discussed by petitioners in his brief, set out a consistent reading of the Supremacy Clause. They preclude states from picking and choosing federal statutes to enforce because they don't like some of them. They preclude states from discriminating against federal law for gerrymandering their rules in a way that discriminates against federal claims. But at the same time, they permit states to create neutral jurisdictional rules to shape their courts when those rules are applied even-handedly to state and to federal claims.
Should it really be based on the question of whether the state courts have jurisdiction of these other actions? I mean, what if a state says, you know, this is our courts are courts of general jurisdiction. They have jurisdiction of almost any action that could be brought. But there's a defense of sovereign immunity available to various state agencies and governmental agencies if you're filing a claim for under state law for a tort. And we think the same sort of rule should be applicable if you're bringing an action under Section 1983.
Well, the court has discussed these cases in jurisdictional terms, and that's why we are emphasizing jurisdiction here. I mean, in the Mayfield case, another one of the cases that follows from Douglas, and the court said, and again quoting from the court's opinion, that when the state denies resort to its courts for reasons of local policy and applies that policy impartially, that is valid. The court didn't explicitly hedge that in terms of jurisdiction, and I'm not sure, therefore, it's necessary to do so. But the reason I think that it's useful to view this case in jurisdictional terms is not only because Florida courts clearly view sovereign immunity as jurisdictional, because as a matter of intent of Congress in writing a statute like 1983, I think it seems to us quite clear that Congress did not have it in mind to override neutral jurisdictional limitations on powers of state courts to entertain claims.
Well, suppose the Florida statute says no Florida court shall have jurisdiction to render judgment against a state agency or officer in his official capacity for more than $10,000. That's the way it's phrased. Would there then be a $10,000 limit on 1983 recovery?
Well, I think that would be a much more difficult case than this one.
Why?
I think that the analysis the court has used in cases like this, and let me set out a range of cases which I think are instructive. In cases like Felder and Martinez, which petitioner relies upon, where federal courts entertain actions under 1983 or under any federal statute, issue in that case is the meaning of the federal statute. The elements of the cause of action, the defenses to the statute, are federal questions. And Felder is a good example of that. The procedural rule there was essentially an exhaustion of remedies requirement. The court said Congress addressed that in 1983 and excluded exhaustion as an element of the action. Therefore, the state's requirement in that action, its attempt to modify the 1983 action, is preempted. The question in a case like that is one of congressional intent, as in any preemption analysis. I think that this case, a classic jurisdictional case, presents a very different sort of question. A cause of action is not typically understood to preempt a limitation on the jurisdiction of courts or to conflict with a limitation on the jurisdiction of courts. And I think, again, cases like Douglas and Mayfield and Herb against Pitcairn show that in this setting where there are state jurisdictional limitations and a federal action, the action typically takes the state courts as it finds them. Now, the case that you hypothesize is sort of a middle case between those two sets of principles. It's a case where the state entertains the 1983 action, and it entertains analogous state law actions. And I think the question of whether Congress would have wanted to preempt the limitation that you describe, even though it's made by the court and by the state in jurisdictional terms, would be a more difficult question than the one here. Now, my answer would be Congress should not be deemed to have wanted to override jurisdictional limitations of that sort. And however the court wants to cabin the jurisdiction of its courts, that should be dispositive. But, again, that is a closer question than this one. There's no question that this sort of sovereign immunity limitation has always been regarded as jurisdictional from prior to the ratification of the Constitution. So there's no question here of the courts.
May I ask about the jurisdictional character? Is it a jurisdictional defect that the school board itself could waive?
Apparently not. There is.
You think the school board answered and the judgment was entered against it, and then 3 years later they could come in and vacate the judgment on the ground that they really didn't have authority to waive jurisdiction?
My understanding of the most recent Florida law is that the waiver is not possible. There is longstanding Florida authority that the legislature must waive sovereign immunity.
So it's even more jurisdictional than the 11th Amendment would be in a case involving brought in the federal court. It's a real strict rule of jurisdiction in your view.
I think that is reflective of the most recent law in Florida, yes.
Which case do you think most strongly supports that proposition by the Florida Supreme Court?
There was a recent case of Florida District Court of Appeal, and I'm afraid I can't give you the name. I'll be happy to.
But is there Supreme Court of Florida authority for the proposition?
Supreme Court of Florida has recently denied to answer a certified question on that point by a state court.
But has the Supreme Court of Florida spoken on the point that you're relying so heavily on?
Not to my knowledge, although, well,
I'm not relying on intermediate court opinions.
I'm not relying on the absence of an ability to waive. I'm relying on the fact that...
What is the strongest Supreme Court of Florida authority that you have for the basic proposition that this is a jurisdictional matter and not something that can be waived?
Offhand, Your Honor, I can't cite you a case. I'll be happy, as I say, to inform
you. No, you don't. If you haven't got it yet, why?
Well, no, we cite a number of cases in the briefs in this case.
The opinion before us in this case is not quite as clear as you suggest it is, I don't think.
Well, I think it is quite clear that the Florida courts do regard sovereign immunity as a defect in subject matter jurisdiction. I mean, the 11th Amendment is as well regarded as a defect in subject matter jurisdiction.
Again, what is the strongest Supreme Court of Florida opinion supporting that proposition?
Well, the question is that can be raised at any time, or?
Well, the one you said, it's definitely a jurisdictional defect.
Well, that one case that is cited in the briefs in this case is Schnaus versus Small, which is actually an intermediate court opinion in Florida.
I've been inquiring about Supreme Court opinion.
No, I
guess
understand.
There really aren't any right on point, are there?
Well, it seems to me, Your Honor, that the intermediate court opinions establish Florida law, I mean, for the purposes of this court, for the purpose of the federal court determining what Florida law means, I think that what the views of an intermediate Florida court are.
Let me just get one other thing clear in my mind, that had this case been brought in the federal court, your defense would not be valid in federal court. You agree with that, don't you?
Yes, that's right. I mean, the state jurisdiction.
Your reason for saying this is not discrimination against the federal cause of action is because you say comparable claims in the state court would also be dismissed.
That's right.
Is the case you referred to in your colloquy with Justice Stevens, the Schnaus against Small, is that cited in your brief?
This, again, is cited in the amicus briefs in the case.
And that you regard as the strongest case from the District Court of Appeal on this question of jurisdictional?
It's the strongest case that is cited in the briefs in this case. I think there are a great many cases. Another case which is cited in the briefs in this case is one called Kaisner versus Call. I think that there is no disputing the proposition. I'm sorry that I can't cite a case from the Supreme Court of Florida, but I'm sure that the Supreme Court has recognized that. I mean, in the Hill case, which is a case from the Supreme Court of Florida, which the District Court of Appeal relied on in this case, I think there are strong indications that it is jurisdictional.
Mr. Rothfeld, when you refer to the amicus brief, you mean the one that bears your name?
That is right, Your Honor.
Because there's more than one here.
Well, the amicus brief for the National Association of Counties, as well as other clients. I think, again, to return, Justice Stevens, lest there be any doubt on this point, I think that there is no question that the Florida courts regard the absence of subject of, well, regard sovereign immunity as establishing a jurisdictional defect which goes to the subject matter jurisdiction of the state courts. I think that petitioner does not take issue with that proposition.
And you mean it's subject matter jurisdiction in the sense that even if they didn't, if they answered and they went to trial and they got a judgment entered against them, and then 5 years later they could come in and set aside the judgment. In that strict sense.
That is my understanding.
You think that's clear from the Florida cases?
I think that, as I say, the latest authority in Florida establishes that proposition.
But your position is that it wouldn't matter, it'd still, even if it were jurisdictional in a lesser sense, a jurisdiction that could be waived as 11th Amendment jurisdiction.
That is absolutely right. I mean, our position, I mean, the question in this case, of course, is whether the state has to entertain the claim in the first instance. And if it does not entertain analogous state law claims, as it does not, we think it is under no federal obligation, constitutional or statutory, to entertain the claim here.
I'm still not quite clear on why the jurisdictional argument makes a difference from Justice Scalia's example of, say, a $10,000 ceiling on recovery. That would be equally non-discriminatory. Why would one raise a different federal question than the other?
Well, I think that the question is whether Congress has wanted to set aside limitation on the jurisdiction of the court simply by enacting a cause of action.
But, I mean, in his example, as the state statute purportedly says, no state court shall have jurisdiction to enter a judgment in excess of $10,000.
No, that's correct, Justice Stevens. And my answer to Justice Scalia ultimately was that, although it was a closer question for the reasons I stated, I think that that would be a valid bar on the jurisdiction.
The thing I don't understand is why it's a closer question from your point of view.
Well, a closer question, I think, only because since the state court is entertaining the action, the question of whether Congress would have wanted to sweep away limitations on that action.
Well, would this be a different case if, in addition to the school board, they also had the police department, so there were two defendants, so they entertained the action, but the question of whether they can bring it against a particular defendant, why would that make it different? There would be subject matter jurisdiction of the claim, but no jurisdiction to enter judgment against the school board.
Well, I think that the court would be open to adjudicate the claim as it is against the individual, but not against a party as to whom it lacks jurisdiction, as to whom a judgment cannot run because it lacks jurisdiction to enter a judgment against that party, because it lacks jurisdiction to entertain.
From lacking jurisdiction to enter an $11,000 judgment. I just don't follow the argument. I guess maybe I'm
well. Let me move away from that hypothetical, because I think the case here is a clear one, because, as I said, there is no doubt that sovereign immunity not only is viewed in Florida as being jurisdictional, but that it is historically, traditionally been viewed in all jurisdictions as going to the jurisdiction of the court. So there's no question here, again, of the state sort of playing semantic games with its statutes to frustrate federal actions. This is a longstanding immunity, lack of authority in the state courts, which is grounded in the Florida Constitution. And it seems highly unlikely make two points. It seems, A, highly unlikely that Congress would have wanted to sweep away such a jurisdictional limitation simply by enacting a cause of action as it did in 1983. And secondly, the Supremacy Clause, clearly under this Court's precedence of its own force, does not impose an obligation on the state courts to entertain actions under those circumstances. And let me address the meaning of 1983 in particular, because that's something that petitioner, I think, sort of runs away from, and for a very good reason. It is quite clear when Congress enacted 1983, it was not intending to impose special burdens on the state courts or forced litigation into the state courts. As Justice O'Connor pointed out in her opinion in Felder, when statute was originally enacted, it vested exclusive jurisdiction in the federal courts. And while that exclusivity has been stripped away during the course of routine housekeeping revisions of the judicial code in subsequent years, there is no indication in the language of 1983 or any other federal statute or in any of the legislative history that Congress intended to force litigation into the state courts. To the contrary, I think it is established beyond any dispute the statute was enacted precisely because Congress mistrusted the state courts, because Congress wanted to create a federal court remedy for deprivations of constitutional rights. And the Court has said over and over, it has become almost a truism, that Congress constituted federal courts the primary vehicles for enforcing Section 1983. It seems very hard to believe that a statute written with that goal in mind was designed to impose a special, unusual obligation on state courts to disregard neutral limitations on their jurisdiction.
Well, Mr. Rothfeld, suppose Florida said our courts are closed to any kind of tort suits against prison officials or guards. We just don't want suits to be brought in our courts, and we close our courts to those kind of suits. But they don't close the courts to suits against policemen.
If the courts were closed in actions against prison officials based on state law as well as on federal law, so that clearly analogous claims were being excluded and there was no sign that the state meant to discriminate against federal claims, I would think that would be a valid limitation on jurisdiction.
Even though they entertain similar suits against all other officials.
I think that's right. And I think that the purpose of the requirement that the state not exclude analogous claims, as the court has said in cases like Testa and Mondu, the cases that petitioner relies upon, is to exclude.
You think there might be an equal protection issue?
I would think not, Your Honor. In the Martinez versus California case, there was a similar limitation on state claims.
I think your view would say that they could also immunize parole board officials, too.
I would think that they could divest their courts of jurisdiction.
Divest them of jurisdiction over the kind of claim that was asserted in Martinez.
If it is done even-handedly, if it applies to state law claims as well, I would think that it
Well, that case, of course, it did. That was a state statute applied to state cases just like federal cases. Well, I think you're saying Martinez is wrong.
No, I am not, Your Honor. And let me be clear on why I'm not. And this goes to my response to Justice Scalia, and perhaps I didn't make that clear. I think that when the state court entertains a federal action, as it did in Martinez, it had jurisdiction to do so, and there was no question about that, the state is obligated to analyze the meaning of the federal statute in federal terms. The elements of the statute and the defenses to the statute are federal questions. In Martinez itself, the court, while holding, as you say, that the state immunity rule was inapplicable in a 1983 action, also expressly reserved the question whether states could exclude 1983 claims altogether.
Altogether.
And suggested in its discussion that the test there was whether analogous claims based on state law were excluded, citing Testa versus Kent. And
I think, but it also quoted from a Seventh Circuit opinion, which is somewhat inconsistent with your argument.
To that point, I can't speak, Your Honor. But I think that the Seventh Circuit citation went directly to the question of whether or not a defense in an action entertained in state court would be a federal question or a state question. And again, I think that is analyzed in standard preemption terms of congressional intent. Since it is a federal question, what the federal statute means, the question of whether any defense or any modification of the cause of action or procedural exhaustion requirement or whatever is valid must be a federal question, and it turns on what Congress meant when it wrote the statute. The preceding question of whether or not the case can get into state court in the first place is a different question. If Congress had wanted in 1983 not only to create a cause of action open to the same extent that state court's causes of action are, but had also wanted to override limitations on state court jurisdiction, it would in terms have said so. It would have said state courts must entertain these actions, notwithstanding limitations on their jurisdiction. But it plainly didn't do any such thing. In fact, as I said when I wrote the statute, it vested exclusive jurisdiction in the federal court. So petitioner, I think, is forced to fall back on some much more general proposition that jurisdictional barriers to federal claims are never valid when they're asserted in state court. And the court has already rejected that proposition.
Mr. Rothfeld, just out of curiosity, why would a plaintiff want to get into state courts rather than federal courts outside of docket problems, backlog problems?
I would think outside of those problems, it is not clear to me, Your Honor, because since, as I've been stating, the elements of the claim are entirely identical, whether in state or federal court. I mean, there are always an element of forum shopping when there's concurrent jurisdiction and two courts are open. But beyond that, I can't. Mr. Beckett will have to give you a response to that. I should add, finally, that the fact that Congress did not vest jurisdiction in the state courts suggests the balance of interest that the court should bear in mind when it decides this case. It would be an extraordinarily intrusive thing for Congress to require state courts to entertain claims when they lack jurisdiction to do so. It has been a fundamental prerogative of the sovereign to determine what claims are heard in the sovereign's own courts. And for Congress to set that aside would be a rather surprising thing. And I think the court would look for a clear expression that Congress had that in mind in writing a statute like 1983. Now, on the other side of the sort of balance of interest, there is not much – the federal interest here is relatively insubstantial. Federal courts are open to entertain actions like this. Under 1983 in particular, the federal courts were made the primary vehicles for entertaining actions like this. And it should not be the law, I think, that a statute like 1983 overrides neutral limitation on the jurisdiction of state courts. And that is not the law. Just 2 months ago in its Taflin decision, the court said that state courts have concurrent jurisdiction over federal claims whenever, by their own constitution, they have power to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Rothfeld. Mr. Beckett, do you have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
You have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. The fourth case that I would have cited in this court's line of what we call intermediate cases where there is an entertaining in the state court of a similar cause of action is Testa. And Testa was a decision written in 1947 by Justice Black, and it, I think, contains important language on the question of which we're thrashing around here about jurisdiction. In Testa, Justice Black said it doesn't make any difference how you characterize the defense, whether you put it on jurisdictional grounds or was done in Testa on the ground that the federal government was a foreign sovereign, and therefore the state of Rhode Island would not enforce a foreign penal statute. The Justice Black answered that by saying, from the federal viewpoint, how you characterize it is immaterial. The question is, do you have a federal cause of action which, had it not been federal rather than state, would have been enforced? And the answer was yes. Rhode Island had a similar statute. The other argument in that connection is a slight misapplication of the idea of the neutral rule, that this claim should be barred because the court does not otherwise entertain this type of claim. The question is whether it entertains the class of claims, which it does. It entertains tort claims. Therefore, under the authorities I cited, the fact that it wants to eliminate the federal claim means it's doing it only on federal.
Florida attempting to immunize from suit only prison officials just wouldn't work.
It wouldn't work because once Florida creates a class, as the Justice Brandeis said, the Alabama courts are courts of general jurisdiction. They can entertain these claims. It must entertain this claim and not discriminate merely because it's federal.
That just all depends upon how you want to define the class.
Precisely correct, Your Honor, and that's.
Don't say it's precisely correct. It means that your point doesn't mean anything.
You
can define the class as prison officials, or you can define the class as tort claims.
You cannot define it simply as the class which is excluded. It has to be defined as membership in a class which is recognized and enforced.
What about membership in a class of lawsuit defendants? You know, it really just depends on what level of generality you're talking about.
That's correct. And we think that there is guidance from this court on that point. The other argument that we have in our brief, which this court, I think, would be interested in, is the so-called half-loaf argument. It's quite clear from such cases as Maine against Thibodeau and Felder that once the state courts entertain a 1983 action, they may not give a half loaf. And in effect, that's what they're doing in this case. They say, we will entertain it, but we won't entertain it against the school board. The question is, when you entertain it, must you bring with the federal cause of action all of the baggage that it has? And the answer to that is yes. And in this case, the liability of the school board is established by this court's decision in Doyle against the Mount Healthy School Board.
Thank you, Mr. Beckett. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.